before. I was on a Kawasaki. The elderly asshole coming the other way was piloting a Chevrolet the size of a cabin cruiser. He wandered into my lane, leaving me a choice, either the soft shoulder or a head-on collision. I picked the obvious choice and made it past the asshole okay. The mistake was trying to swerve back onto the road at 40. Advice to all you novice riders out there, swerving on gravel at 40 is a terrible idea. I dumped the bike and broke the leg in 5 places. I also shattered my hip. Shortly thereafter, I discovered the joy of morphine. With my leg feeling better and the itches and twitches at bay, I was able to move on from the gas station with a bit more vigor. And by the time I got to the Greyhound terminal, I was asking myself why I'd stuck with Kelly Van Dorn and his screwed-up country band as long as I had, playing weepy ballads in the key of C, for God's sake, was not what I was cut out for. I was a rocker, not a shit-kicker. I purchased a ticket on the following day's noon bus to Chicago, which also bought me the right to stash my duffel and my Gibson SG, the only valuable possession I had left, in the baggage room. The ticket cost me $29. I counted the rest sitting in a bathroom stall. It came to $159, about what I had expected. The future was looking brighter. I would score at the fair, find a place to crash, maybe at a local homeless shelter, maybe outside, and tomorrow I'd ride the big gray dog to Chi-Town. There was a musician's exchange there, as there is in most big cities, with players sitting around, telling jokes, swapping gossip, and looking for gigs. For some, this wasn't easy. Accordion players, for instance. The bands were always looking for competent rhythm guitar players, and I was a smidge more than that. By 1992, I could even play a little lead, if called upon to do so. And if I wasn't too wrecked. The important thing was to get to Chicago and get a gig before Kelly Van Dorn put out the word that I was unreliable, and the pisshead just might. With at least 6 hours to kill until dark, I cooked up the rest of my shit and put it where it would do the most good. Once that was taken care of, I bought a paperback Western at the newsstand, sat on a bench with it open to someplace in the middle, and nodded off. When I woke myself up with a volley of sneezes, it was 7 o'clock, and time for the former rhythm guitarist of White Lightning to hunt up some of the good stuff. By the time I got to the fair, sunset was just a bitter orange line in the west. Although I wanted to save most of my money for a buy, I splurged on a taxi to get there, because I wasn't feeling good at all. It wasn't just the usual coming down twitches and aches, either. The sore throat was back. There was a high, sour humming in my ears, and I felt hot all over. I told myself that last was normal, because it was one hot bitch kitty of a night. As for the rest, I was sure 6 or 7 hours of sleep would put me right. I could catch it on the bus. I wanted to be all I could be before I re-enlisted in the rock and roll army. I bypassed the main entrance to the fair, because only an idiot would attempt to buy heroin at a craft exhibit or livestock exhibition. Beyond it was the entrance to Bell's Amusement Park. That adjunct to the Tulsa State Fair is gone now. But in September of 1992, Bell's was blasting away full force. Both roller coasters, the wooden Zingo and the more modern Wildcat, were whirling and twirling, trailing happy screams behind each hairpin turn and suicidal plunge. There were long lines at the water slides, the Himalaya, and the Phantasmagoria dark ride. I ignored these and idled my way down the midway past the food concessions, where the smells of fried dough and sausages, usually enticing, made me feel a little sick to my stomach. There was a guy with the right look hanging around the pitch-till-you-win shy, and I almost approached him, but caught a narc vibe when I got close. The shirt he was wearing, "Cocaine, Breakfast of Champions," was just a little too on the nose. I kept moving, past the shooting gallery, the wooden milk bottle shy, the skee ball, the Wheel of Fortune. I was feeling worse all the time, my skin hotter, and that humming in my ears louder. My throat was so sore I winced with every swallow. Up ahead was an elaborate mini-golf layout. It was mostly filled with laughing teenagers, and I thought I had arrived at ground zero. Wherever there are teenagers out for a night of fun, there are dealers in the vicinity who are happy to help them maximize said fun. And, oh yeah, I could see a couple of fellows who had just the right look. By their shifty eyes and unwashed hair, shalt thou know them. The midway ended at a T-junction beyond the mini-golf, one way leading back to the fairgrounds, the other to the racetrack. I had no desire to go to either place, but I'd been hearing a strange electric crackle off to the right, followed by applause, laughter, and cries of amazement. Now, as I drew closer to the junction, I could see that each crackle was accompanied by a bright blue flash that reminded me of lightning. The lightning on Skytop, to be perfectly specific. I hadn't thought of that in years. Whatever the gaff was, it had drawn a big crowd. I decided the Sharpies hanging around the golf course could wait a few minutes. Guys like that never go away until they shut off the neon. And I wanted to see who was making the lightning on this hot and clear Oklahoma night. An amplified voice cried, "Now that you've seen the power of my lightning maker, the only one in the world, I assure you, I'll give an actual demonstration of the wonderful portrait, that one portrait of Alexander Hamilton from your wallet or purse will buy you, one amazing demonstration before I open my electric studio and offer you the chance to sit for the photographic representation of a lifetime. But I'll need a volunteer, so you'll see exactly what you'll be getting for the best $10 you ever spent. Volunteer? May I have a volunteer? It's perfectly safe, I assure you. Come on, folks. I always heard Sooners were famous in the lower 48 for their bravery." There was a good-sized crowd, 50 or 60, in front of a raised stage. The canvas backdrop was 6 feet wide and at least 20 feet high. On it was a photograph almost as big as a movie screen image. It featured a beautiful young woman on what appeared to be a ballroom floor. Her black hair was piled atop her head in a series of complicated twirls and tucks that must have taken hours to create. Her strapless evening gown was cut low, the top of her breasts curving sweetly above it. She was wearing diamond earrings and blood-red lipstick. Facing the giant ballroom girl was an old-fashioned camera, the 19th-century kind that stands on a tripod and has a black drape the photographer can throw over his head. Placed as it was, you would have said it could only snap the ballroom girl from the knees down. Next to it was a flash-powder tray on a post. The black-suited, top-hatted Gaffmeister had one loosely curled hand on the camera, and I knew him at once. All that is clear, but my memory of what happened next is untrustworthy. I freely admit it. I was a long-time junkie who had graduated to the needle 2 years previous. First, just skin-popping, but more and more frequently aiming for the vein. I was malnourished and severely underweight. On top of that, I was running a temperature. It was the flu, and had come on fast. Getting up that morning, I thought I just had the usual case of heroin sniffles, a cold at worst. But by the time I saw Charles Jacobs standing beside an old-fashioned tripod camera and in front of a canvas backdrop with "Portraits and Lightning" written over a giant girl, I felt like I was living in a dream. It didn't surprise me to see my old minister, now with touches of gray at his temples and lines, faint ones, bracketing his mouth. It wouldn't have surprised me if my late mother and sister had joined him on stage, dressed as Playboy bunnies. A couple of men raised their hands in response to Jacob's call for volunteers, but he laughed and pointed at the beautiful girl looming over his shoulder. "I'm sure you guys are brave as the devil on Saturday night, but none of you would look good in a strapless." Good-natured laughter greeted this. "I want a gal," said the fellow who showed me Peaceable Lake when I was but a tyke in short pants. "I want a pretty gal, a pretty little Sooner gal. How about you folks? You down with that? They clapped their hands to show how down with it they were, and Jacobs, who had surely already picked out his mark, pointed his cordless mic towards someone in the front of the crowd. How about you, miss? You're about as pretty a gal as anyone could want. I was at the back of the tip, but the crowd seemed to part before me as if I were possessed of some magical repelling force. Probably I just elbowed my way forward, but I don't remember it that way, and if anyone elbowed me back, I don't remember that either. I seemed to float forward. All the colors were brighter now, the tootling of the carousel calliope and the screams from the Zingo louder. The humming in my ears had escalated to a tuneful ringing, G7, I think. I moved through an aromatic atmosphere of perfume, aftershave, and discount store hairspray. The pretty sooner gal was protesting, but her friends were having none of that. They pushed her forward, and she mounted the steps on the left side of the stage, tanned thighs flashing beneath the frayed hem of her short denim skirt. Above the skirt was a green smock that was high at the neck but left a flirty inch of midriff revealed. Her hair was blonde and long. A few men whistled. "Every pretty girl carries her own positive charge," Jacobs told the crowd, and swept off his top hat. I saw him clench the hand holding it. For just a moment I felt sensations I hadn't since that day at Skytop. Goose flesh on my arms, hair standing to attention on the nape of my neck, the air too heavy in my lungs. Then the tray beside the camera exploded with something that was certainly not flash powder, and the canvas backdrop lit up in a dazzling blue glare. The face of the girl in the evening gown was blotted out. As the dazzle faded, I saw in her place, or thought I saw, the 50-something country girl who had kicked me out of the fairgrounds inn some 9 hours earlier. Then the girl in the low-cut, spangly gown was back. It wowed the crowd, and it wowed me, too. But it didn't completely surprise me. Reverend Jacobs up to his old tricks, that was all. Nor did it surprise me when he put his arm around the girl, turned her to face us, and for an instant, I thought it was Astrid Soderberg, once more 16 years old, and worried about getting pregnant. Astrid, who sometimes used to blow smoke from her Virginia Slims into my mouth, giving me a hard-on for the ages. Then she was just a pretty little sooner gal again, in from the farm, and ready for a night of fun. Jacob's assistant, a kid with zits and a bad haircut, trotted out with an ordinary wooden chair. He put it in front of the camera, then made a comic business of dusting off Jacob's old-fashioned frock coat. "Sit down, honey," Jacob said, ushering the girl to the chair. "I promise you a shockingly good time." He waggled his eyebrows, and his young assistant did a little electric jitter. The audience yucked it up. Jacob's eyes found me, now in the first row, passed on, then came back. After a second's consideration, they moved on again. "Will it hurt?" the girl asked, and now I saw she didn't look much like Astrid after all. Of course not. She was much younger than my first girlfriend would be now, and wherever Astrid might be, her last name was almost surely no longer Soderberg. "Not a bit," Jacobs assured her. "And unlike any other lady who dares to step forward, your portrait will be..." He looked away from her, back at the crowd, this time directly at me. "Absolutely free." He seated her in the chair, continuing with the patter, but he seemed a little hesitant now, as if he had lost the thread. He kept glancing at me as his assistant fastened a white silk blindfold over the girl's eyes. If he was distracted, the crowd didn't notice. A petite, pretty girl was about to be photographed at the feet of a giant, beautiful girl, while blindfolded no less, and all that was very interesting. So was the fact that the live girl was showing a lot of leg, and the one in the backdrop was showing a lot of cleavage. "Who wants?" the pretty girl began, and Jacobs promptly put his microphone in front of her mouth so she could share a question with the whole crowd. A picture of me wearing a blindfold. The rest of you sure ain't blindfolded, hon, someone yelled, and the crowd cheered good-naturedly. The girl in the chair pressed her knees tightly together, but she was smiling a little, too. The old, I'm being a good sport smile. My dear, I think you'll be surprised, Jacob said. Then he turned to address the crowd. Electricity. Although we take it for granted, it's the greatest natural wonder of our world. The Great Pyramid of Giza is only an anthill in comparison. It's the foundation of our modern civilization. Some claim to understand it, ladies and gentlemen, but none understand the secret electricity, that power which binds the very universe into one harmonic whole. Do I understand it? No, I do not. Not fully. Yet I know its power to destroy, to heal, and to create magical beauty. What's your name, miss?
Kathy Morse.
Kathy, there's an old saying that beauty is in the eye of the beholder. You and I and everyone here is going to witness the truth of that saying tonight. And when you walk away, you'll have a portrait you can show your grandchildren, a portrait they'll show to their grandchildren. And if those as yet unborn ancestors don't marvel over it, my name's not Dan Jacobs. But it isn't, I thought. I was swaying back and forth now, as if to the music of the calliope and the music I was hearing in my ears. I tried to stop and found I couldn't. My legs had a strangely meaty feel, as if the bones were being extracted inch by inch. You're Charles, not Dan. Do you think I don't know the man who gave my brother back his voice? Now, ladies and gentlemen, you may want to shield your eyes. The assistant theatrically covered his own. Jacobs whirled, puffed up the black cloth on the back of the camera, and disappeared beneath it. Close your eyes, Kathy, he called. Even beneath the blindfold, an electrical pulse this powerful can be dazzling. I'll count to three. One, and two, and three. Once again, I felt that strange thickening of the air, and I wasn't alone. The crowd shuffled back a step or two. Next came a hard click, as if someone had snapped his fingers beside my right ear. The world lit up in a blue burst of light. Went the crowd, and when they could see again and realize what had become of the backdrop, the evening gown was the same, low-cut, spangled silver. The inviting curve of the bosom was the same, as was the complicated hairdo. But the breasts were now smaller, and the hair was blonde instead of black. The face had changed, too. It was Kathy Moore standing there on the ballroom floor. Then I blinked, and the pretty little Sooner gal was gone. It was Astrid again. Astrid, as she had been at 16, the love of my days and the eventually requited lust of my nights. The crowd exhaled a low gust of astonishment. And I had an idea that was both crazy and persuasive. They were also seeing people from their own back pages, those either gone or changed by the fluid passage of time. Then it was just Kathy Morse. But that was astounding enough. Kathy Morse, standing 20 feet high in the sort of expensive gown she would never own in real life. The diamond earrings were there, and although the lipstick of the girl in the chair was candy pink, that of giant Kathy behind her was bright red. No sign of a blindfold, either. Same old Reverend Jacobs, I thought. But he's learned some tricks a lot flashier than electric Jesus walking across peaceable lake or a cloth belt with a toy motor inside it. He popped out from beneath the black cloth, tossed it back, and pulled a plate from the back of his camera. He showed it to the audience, and they went, again. Jacobs bowed, then turned to Kathy, who was looking mighty puzzled. He held the plate out to her and said, "You may take off the blindfold, Kathy. It's safe now." She slipped it down and saw the picture on the plate. An Oklahoma girl somehow transformed into a costly French courtesan of the demi-monde. Her hands went to her mouth, but Jacobs had the mic right there, and everyone heard her,
Oh, my God!
Now turn around, Jacobs cried. She stood, turned, looked, and reeled back the sight of herself, 20 feet high and tricked out in high-class glitter. Jacobs put an arm around her waist to steady her. His mic hand, which was also concealing some sort of control device, clenched again. And this time the crowd did more than gasp. There were a few screams as well. The giant Kathy Morris did a slow fashion model turn, revealing the back of the gown, which was cut much lower than the front. She looked over her shoulder and winked. Jacobs did not neglect the mic. He was clearly an old hand at this. And the tip heard the real Kathy's follow-up exclamation as clearly as they heard the first. Oh, my fucking God. They laughed. They cheered. And when they saw her bright crimson blush, they cheered even harder. Above Jacobs and the girl, the giant Kathy was changing. The blonde hair grew muddy. The features faded, although the red lipstick remained bright, like the grin of the Cheshire Cat in Alice. Then it was the original girl again. The image of Kathy Morris had faded out of existence. But this version will never fade, Jacob said, holding up the old-fashioned plate again. My assistant will print it and frame it, and you can pick it up before you go home tonight. Watch out there, Slick, someone in the front row yelled out. Girl's gonna faint. But she didn't. She only swayed a little on her feet. I was the one who fainted. When I next opened my eyes, I was in a queen-size bed. A blanket was pulled up to my chin. When I looked to my right, I saw a wall done in fake wood paneling. When I looked to my left, I saw a nice kitchen area. Fridge, sink, microwave oven. Beyond it was a couch, a dinette with 4 chairs, even an easy chair in the living area facing the built-in TV. I couldn't crane my neck far enough to see the driving compartment, but as an itinerant musician who had traveled tens of thousands of miles in similar rigs, although few as squared away as this one, I knew where I was anyway. A large RV, probably a bounder. Someone's home away from home. I was hot, burning up. My mouth was dry as road dust. I was also jonesing like a motherfucker. I pushed the blanket down and immediately started shivering. A shadow fell over me. It was Jacobs, holding out a beautiful thing, orange juice in a tall glass with a bendy straw sticking out of it. The only thing better would have been a loaded hypo, but one thing at a time. I held my hand out for the glass. He pulled the blanket back up first, then took a knee beside the bed. Slow, Jamie. You're one sick American, I'm afraid. I drank. It was wonderful in my throat. I tried to take the glass and chug it down, but he held it away from me. Slow, I said. I dropped my hand, and he gave me another sip. It went down fine, but on the third one, my belly clenched and the shivers came back. That wasn't the flu. I need to score, I said. This was hardly the way I wanted to reintroduce myself to my former minister and first adult friend. But a junkie in need has no shame. Besides, he might have a skeleton or two in his own closet. Why else would he be going under the name Dan Jacobs instead of Charles? Yes, he said. I saw the tracks. And I intend to maintain you, at least until you've beaten whatever bug you've got running around in your system. Otherwise, you'll start throwing up whatever I try to feed you, and we can't have that, can we? Not when you look to be at least 50 pounds underweight as it is. From his pocket, he brought a brown Graham bottle. It had a small spoon attached to the cap. I reached for it. He shook his head and held it away from me. Same deal. I do the driving. He unscrewed the cap, dipped out a tiny spoonful of grimy white powder, and held it under my nose. I snorted it up my right nostril. He dipped again, and I treated the left nostril. It wasn't what I needed, not enough of what I needed, to be exact, but the shakes began to subside, and I stopped feeling like I might hurl up that nice cold orange juice. "Now you can doze," he said. "Or nod off, if that's what you call it. I'm going to make you some chicken soup. Just Campbell's, not like your mother used to make, but it's what I've got." "I don't know if I can hold it down," I said, but it turned out I could. When I'd finished the mug he held for me, I asked for more dope. He administered 2 very stingy snorts. "Where'd you get it?" I asked as he tucked the bottle back into a front pocket of the jeans he was now wearing. He smiled. It lit up his face and made him 25 again, with a wife he loved and a young son he adored. "Jamie," he said, "I've been working amusement parks in the Kearney Circuit for a long time now. If I couldn't find drugs, I'd be either blind or an idiot. I need more. I need a shot." "Nope. A shot's what you want, and you're not going to get it from me. I have no interest in helping you get high. I just don't want you to go into convulsions and die in my boondocker. Go to sleep now. It's nearly midnight. If you're better in the morning, we'll discuss many things, including how to detach the monkey currently riding on your back. If you're not better, I'm taking you to either St. Francis or the OSU Medical Center." "Good luck getting them to take me," I said. "I'm 2 steps from broke, and my medical plan is convenience store Tylenol." In the words of Scarlett O'Hara, "We'll worry about that tomorrow, for tomorrow is another day."
"Fiddly-dee," I croaked.
"If you say so."
"Give me a little more."
The short snorts he doled out were about as useful to me as a Marlboro Light to a guy who's been chain-smoking Chesterfield Kings all his life. But even short snorts were better than nothing. He considered, then parceled out 2 more hits, even stingier than the last pair. "Giving heroin to a man with a bad case of the flu," he said and chuckled. "I must be crazy." I peeked under the blanket and saw he'd undressed me down to my skivvies.
"Where are my clothes?"
"In the closet. I segregated them from mine, I'm afraid. They smelled a trifle gamey."
"My wallet's in the front pocket of my jeans. There's a claim check for my duffel bag and my guitar. The clothes don't matter, but the guitar does."
"Bus station or train station?"
"Bus."
The dope might only have been powder and administered in medicinal quantities, but either it was very good stuff or it was hitting my depleted body especially hard. The soup was warm in my belly, and my eyelids felt like sash weights. "Sleep, Jamie," he said and gave my shoulder a little squeeze. "If you're going to beat the bug, you have to sleep." I lay back on the pillow. It was much softer than the one in my Fairgrounds Inn room.
"Why are you calling yourself Dan?"
"Because it's my name. Charles Daniel Jacobs. Now go to sleep."
I was going to, but there was one other thing I had to ask.
Adults change, sure. But if they haven't been struck by some debilitating disease or disfigured by an accident, you can usually recognize them. Children, on the other hand.
"You knew me. I could see it. How?"
"Because your mother lives in your face, Jamie. I hope Laura's well."
"She's dead. Her and Claire both."
I don't know how he took it. I closed my eyes, and 10 seconds later, I was out. When I woke up, I felt cooler, but the shakes were back big time. Jacobs put a drugstore fever strip on my forehead, held it there for a minute or so, then nodded.
"You might live," he said,
and gave me 2 more teensy snorts from the brown bottle. "Can you get up and eat some scrambled eggs?"
"Oh, bathroom first."
He pointed, and I made my way into the small cubicle, holding on to things. I only had to pee, but I was too weak to stand up, so I sat down and did it girly style. When I came out, he was scrambling eggs and whistling. My stomach rumbled. I tried to recall when I'd last eaten something more substantial than canned soup. Cold cuts backstage before the gig 2 nights ago came to mind. If I'd eaten anything after that, I couldn't remember it. Ingest slowly, he said, setting the plate on the dinette table.
You don't want to bark it right back up again, do you? I ate slowly and cleaned the plate. He sat across from me, drinking coffee. When I asked for some, he gave me half a cup, heavy on the half and half.
The trick with the picture, I said. How did you do that?
Trick? You wound me.
The image on the backdrop is coated with a phosphorescent substance. The camera is also an electrical generator.
That much I got.
The flash is very powerful and very special. It projects the image of the subject onto that of the girl in the evening dress. It doesn't hold for long. The area is too large. The pictures I sell, on the other hand, last much longer.
Long enough so she can show it to her grandchildren.
Really?
Well, he said, no. How long?
2 years, give or take.
By which time, you're long gone.
Indeed. And the pictures of matter, he tapped his temple, up here, for all of us. Don't you agree?
But, Reverend Jacobs,
I saw a momentary flicker of the man who had preached the terrible sermon back when LBJ was president. Please don't call me that. Plain old Dan will do. That's who I am now. Dan the Lightning Portraits Man. Or Charlie, if that's more comfortable for you.
But she turned around. The girl in your background did a complete 360.
A simple trick of motion picture projection. But he glanced away as he said it. Then he looked back at me. Do you want to get better, Jamie?
I am better. Must have been one of those 24-hour things.
It's not a 24-hour thing. It's the flu. And if you try leaving here for the bus station, it'll be back full blast by noon. Stay here, and yes, I think you'll probably be better in a few days, but it's not the flu I'm talking about.
I'm okay, I said,
but now it was my turn to look away. What brought my eyes back front and center was the little brown bottle. He was holding it up by the spoon and swinging it on its little silver chain like a hypnotist's amulet. I reached for it. He held it away. How long have you been using?
Heroin? About 3 years.
It had been 6.
I had a motorcycle accident. Smashed the hell out of my hip and leg. They gave me morphine.
Of course they did.
And then stepped me down to codeine. That sucked, so I started chugging cough syrup to go with the pills. Turpinhydrate, ever heard of it?
Are you kidding?
On the circuit they call it GI gin. My leg healed, but it never healed right. Then I was in a band called the Andersonville Rockers, or maybe they changed his name to the Georgia Giants by then. This guy introduced me to Tussinex. That was a big step in the right direction, as far as pain control went. Listen, do you really want to hear this?
Absolutely.
I shrugged as if it didn't matter much to me one way or the other, but it was a relief to spill it out. Before that day in Jacob's Bounder, I never had. In the bands I played with, everyone just shrugged and looked the other way. As long as you kept showing up, that was, and remembered the chords to In the Midnight Hour, which, believe me, ain't rocket science. It's another cough syrup, more powerful than turpinhydrate, but only if you knew how to get at the good stuff. To do that, you tied a string around the neck of the bottle and twirled it like a mad bastard. The centrifugal force separated the syrup into 3 levels, the good stuff, the hydrocodone, was in the middle. You used a straw to suck it up.
Fascinating.
Not very, I thought. After a while, when I was still having pain, I started scoring morphine again. Then I discovered heroin worked as well and at half the price. I smiled. There's a kind of drug stock market, you know. When everybody started using rock cocaine, horse took a nosedive.
Your leg looks fine to me, he said mildly. There's a bad scar, and there's obviously been some muscle loss, but not that much.
Some doctor did a fine job on you. I can walk, yeah, but you try standing on a leg that's full of metal clips and screws for 3 hours a night under hot lights with a 9-pound guitar strapped on. Lecture all you want. You picked me up when I was down, and I guess I owe you that, but don't tell me about pain. Nobody knows unless they're on the inside. He nodded. As someone who suffered losses, I can relate to that. But here's something I bet you already know deep down. It's your brain that's hurting and blaming it on your leg. Brains are crafty that way. He put the bottle back in his pocket. I watched it go with deep regret and leaned forward, his eyes locked on mine. But I believe I can take care of you with an electrical treatment. No guarantees, and the treatment might not cure your mental craving forever. But I believe I can give you what the football players call running room. Cure me the way you did Connie, I suppose. When that kid clotheslined him with a ski pole. He looked surprised, then laughed. You remember that? Of course. How could I forget it? I also remembered how Con had refused to go with me to see Jacobs after the terrible sermon. It wasn't exactly like Peter denying Jesus, but it was in the same ballpark. A dubious cure at best, Jamie. More likely the placebo effect. I'm offering you an actual cure. One that will, or so I believe, short-circuit the painful withdrawal process. Well, of course you'd say that, wouldn't you? You're judging me by my carny persona. But that's all it is, Jamie. A persona. When I'm not wearing my show suit and making a living, I try to tell the truth. In fact, I mostly tell the truth when I'm working. That picture will amaze Kathy Morse's friends. Yeah, I said. For 2 years, anyway, give or take. Stop dodging and answer my question. Do you want to get better? What came to mind was the P.S. of the note Kelly Van Dorn had slid under my door. In prison a year from now, if I didn't clean up my act, he'd written. And that was if I struck lucky. I got straight 3 years ago. Sort of true, although I had been on the marijuana maintenance program. Did it righteous. Went through the shakes and sweats and the Hershey squirts. My leg was so bad I could barely hobble. It's some kind of nerve damage. I believe I can take care of that, too. What are you? Some kind of miracle worker? Is that what you want me to believe? He'd been sitting on the carpet beside the bed. Now he got up. That's enough for now. You need to sleep. You're still quite a long way from well. Then give me something that will help me. He did so without argument, and it helped me. It just didn't help enough. By 1992, real help came in the needle. There was nothing else. You don't just wave a magic wand over that shit and make it gone. Or so I believed. I stayed in his bounder for the best part of a week, living on soup, sandwiches, and nasally administered doses of heroin that were just enough to keep the worst of the shakes at bay. He brought my guitar and duffel. I kept a spare set of works in the duffel, but when I looked, it was a second night, and he was working the crowds at the Portraits and Lightning Shy. The kit was gone. I begged him to give it back, along with enough heroin so I could cook and shoot up. Nope, he said. If you want a mainline, I've only been skin-popping. He gave me an oh, please, look. If you want that, you'll have to find the proper equipment yourself. If you're not well enough to do it tonight, you will by tomorrow. And around this place, I'm sure it wouldn't take you long. Just don't come back here. When do I get this so-called miracle cure? When you're well enough to withstand a small application of electricity to your frontal lobe. I felt cold at that. I swung my legs out of his bed. He was sleeping on the pull-out couch, and watched him take off his show clothes, hanging them up carefully, and replacing them with a pair of plain white pajamas that looked like something inmate extras might wear in a horror movie set in an insane asylum. Sometimes I wondered if he might not belong in an asylum.
and not because he was running what was essentially a carny wonder show. Sometimes, especially when he talked about the curative powers of electricity, he got a look in his eyes that didn't seem sane. It was not unlike the way he'd looked when he preached himself out of a job in Harlow. Charlie, this is what I called him now, are you talking about shock treatment? He looked at me soberly, buttoning the top of his white inmate pajamas. Yes and no. Certainly not in the conventional sense, because I don't intend to treat you with conventional electricity. My spiel sounds unbelievable, because it's what the customers want. They don't come here for reality, Jamie. They come for fantasy. But there really is a secret electricity, and its uses are manifold. I just haven't discovered all of them yet, and that includes the one that interests me most. Want to share? No. I gave several exhausting performances, and I need sleep. I hope you'll still be here in the morning, but if you're not, that's your choice. Once upon a time, you would have said there are no real choices, only God's will. That was a different man, a young fellow with naive beliefs. Will you wish me good night? I did, then lay in the bed he had given up so I could use it. He was no longer a preacher, but still of the Good Samaritan stripe in so many ways. I hadn't been naked, like the man who had been set upon by robbers on his way to Jericho, but heroin had robbed me of plenty for sure. He had fed me and given me shelter and propped me up with just enough horse to keep me from going out of my fucking mind. The question now was whether or not I wanted to give him a chance to blast my brain waves flat or outright kill me by shooting megavolts of special electricity into my head. 5 times, maybe 10 or a dozen, I thought I would get up and drag the midway until I found somebody who would sell me what I needed. That need was like a drill bit in my head, boring in deeper and deeper. Nasally administered sips of H didn't cut it. I needed a big blast direct to the central nervous system. Once, I actually swung my legs out of bed and reached for my shirt, determined to do it and get it done. But then I lay back down again, shaking and sweating and twitching. Finally, I began to drift off. I let myself go, thinking, tomorrow, I'll leave tomorrow. But I stayed. And on my 5th morning, I think it was the 5th, Jacob slipped behind the wheel of his Bounder, keyed the engine, and said, let's take a ride. I had no choice about it, unless I wanted to open the door and jump out, because we were already rolling. Chapter 6. The Electrical Treatment. A Nighttime Excursion. 1 Pissed Off Oaky. A Ticket on the Mountain Express. Jacob's electrical workshop was in West Tulsa. I don't know what that part of town is like now, but in 1992, it was a forlorn industrial zone where a lot of the industries seemed to be dead or dying. He pulled into the parking lot of an all-but-destitute strip mall on Olympia Avenue and parked in front of Wilson Auto Body. It was standing empty for a long time. That's what the realtor told me, Jacob said. He was dressed in faded jeans and a blue golf shirt, his hair washed and combed, his eyes sparkling with excitement. Just looking at him made me nervous. I had to take a year's lease, but it was still dirt cheap. Come on in. You ought to take down the sign and put up your own, I said. I framed it with hands that were only shaking a little. Portraits and Lightning. C.D. Jacobs, proprietor. It would look good. I won't be in Tulsa that long, he said. And the portraits are really just a way of supporting myself while I conduct my experiments. I've come a long way since my pastoral days, but I've still got a long way to go. You have no idea. Come in, Jamie. Come in. He unlocked a door and led me through an office that was empty of furniture, although I could still see square, clean patches on the grimy linoleum where the legs of a desk had once stood. On the wall was a curling calendar with April 1989 showing. The garage had a corrugated metal roof, and I expected it to be baking under the September sun, but it was wonderfully cool. I could hear the whisper of air conditioners. When he flicked a bank of switches, recently modified, judging from the makeshift way the wires stuck out of the uncovered holes where the plates had been, a dozen brilliant lights came on. If not for the oil-darkened concrete and the rectangular caverns where the two lifts had once been, you would have thought it was an operating theater.
It must have cost a fortune to air-condition this place, I said, especially when you got all those lights blazing.
Dirt cheap. The air conditioners are my own design. They draw very little power, and most of that I generate myself. I could generate all of it, but I wouldn't want Tulsa Power and Light down here, snooping around to find out if I was volt-jacking somehow. As for the lights, you could wrap a hand around one of the bulbs without burning yourself, or even heating your skin, for that matter. Our footfalls echoed in all that empty space. So did our voices. It was like being in the company of phantoms. It just feels that way because I'm strung out, I told myself.
Listen, Charlie, you're not messing with anything radioactive, are you?
He grimaced and shook his head. Nuclear is the last thing I'm interested in. It's energy for idiots, a dead end.
So how do you generate the juice?
Electricity breeds electricity. If you know what you're doing. Leave it at that. Step over here, Jamie. There were three or four long tables at the end of the room with electrical stuff on them. I recognized an oscilloscope, a spectrometer, and a couple of things that resembled Marshall amps, but could have been batteries of some kind. There was a control board that looked mostly torn apart, and several stacked consoles with darkened dials. Thick electrical cords snaked every which way. Some disappeared into closed metal containers that could have been craftsman tool chests. Others just looped back to the dark equipment.
This could all be a fantasy, I thought.
Equipment that only comes alive in his imagination. But the portraits and lightning weren't make-believe. I had no idea how he was making those. His explanation had been vague at best, but he was making them. And although I was standing directly beneath one of those brilliant lights, it really did not seem to be throwing any heat.
There doesn't seem to be much here, I said doubtfully. I expected more.
Flashing lights, chrome-plated knife switches sticking out of science fiction control panels, Star Trek telescreens, possibly a teleportation chamber or a hologram of Noah's Ark in a cloud chamber. He laughed cheerily.
Oh, nothing like that, I said, although he had pretty much hit the nail on the head. It just seems kind of sparse.
It is. I've gone about as far as I can for the time being. I've sold some of my equipment. Other stuff, more controversial stuff, I've dismantled and put in storage. I've done good work in Tulsa, especially considering how little spare time I have. Keeping body and soul together is an annoying business, as I suppose you know.
I certainly did.
But yes, I made some progress toward my ultimate goal. Now I need to think, and I don't believe I can do that when I'm turning half a dozen tips a night.
Your ultimate goal being what?
He ignored the question this time, too. Step over here, Jamie. Would you like a small pick-me-up before we begin? I wasn't sure I wanted to begin, but I wanted a pick-me-up all right. Not for the first time, I considered just snatching the little brown bottle and running. Only he'd probably catch me and wrest it away. I was younger and almost over the flu, but he was still in better shape. He hadn't suffered a shattered hip and leg in a motorcycle accident, for one thing. He grabbed a paint-spattered wooden chair and set it in front of one of the black boxes that looked like a Marshall amp. Sit here. But I didn't. Not right away. There was a picture on one of the tables, the kind with a little wedge on the back to prop it up. He saw me reach for it and made a move as if to stop me. Then he just stood there. A song on the radio can bring back the past with fierce, if mercifully transitory, immediacy. A first kiss, a good time with your buddies, or an unhappy life passage. I can never hear Fleetwood Mac's Go Your Own Way without thinking of my mother's last painful weeks. That spring, it seemed to be on the radio every time I turned it on. A picture can have the same effect. I looked at this one, and all at once, I was 8 again. My sister was helping Maury set up dominoes in Toy Corner while Patsy Jacobs played Bringing in the Sheaves, swaying on the piano bench, her smooth blonde hair shifting from side to side. It was a studio portrait. Patsy was wearing the sort of billowy, shin-length dress that went out of fashion years ago, but it looked good on her. The kid was on her lap, wearing short pants and a sweater vest. A cowlick, I remembered well, stuck up on the back of his head. "We used to call him Tagalong Maury," I said, running my fingers lightly over the glass. "Did you?" I didn't look up. His unsteady voice made me afraid of what I might see in his eyes. "Yeah, and all of us boys were in love with your wife. Claire was, too. I think Mrs. Jacobs was what she wanted to be." At the thought of my sister, my own eyes began to fill up. I could tell you it was just because I was physically low and full of craving. And it would be the truth, but not the whole truth. I swiped an arm across my face and set the picture down. When I looked up, he was fiddling with a voltage regulator that didn't look like it needed fiddling with. "You never remarried?" "No," he said. "Never even close. Patsy and Maury were all I wanted. Needed. There's not a day when I don't think of them. Not a month when I don't have a dream that they're okay. It was the accident that was the dream, I think. Then I wake up. Tell me something, Jamie. Your mother and your sister, do you ever wonder where they are? If they are?" "No." Any scraps of belief that survived the terrible sermon had withered away in high school and college. I see. He dropped the regulator and turned on the thing that looked like a Marshall amp, the kind of amp the bands I played with could rarely afford. It hummed, but not like a Marshall. This sound was lower and almost musical. "Well, let's get on with it, shall we?" I looked at the chair, but didn't sit on it. "You were going to give me a little hit first?" So I was. He produced a brown bottle, considered it, then handed it to me. "Since we can hope this will be your last, why don't you do the honors?" He didn't have to ask twice. I took 2 heaping snorts and would have doubled down if he hadn't snatched the small bottle away. Nevertheless, a window on a tropic beach opened in my head. A mellow breeze wafted in, and I suddenly no longer cared about what might become of my brainwaves. I sat down in the chair. He opened one of several wall cabinets and brought out a pair of battered, taped-up headphones with crisscrosses of metal mesh over the ear pads. He plugged them into the amp-like device and held them out to me. "If I hear Inagata De Vida, I'm taillights," I said. He smiled and said nothing. I put the headphones on. The mesh was cool against my ears. "Have you tried this on anyone?" I asked. "Will it hurt?" "It won't hurt," he said, not answering the first question at all. As if to contradict this, he gave me a mouth guard of the type basketball players sometimes wear, then smiled at my expression. "Just a precaution. Pop it on in." I popped it on in. From his pocket, he took a white plastic box no bigger than a doorbell. "I think you'll..." But then he pressed a button on the little box, and I lost the rest. There was no blackout, no sense of time passing, no discontinuity at all. Just a click, very loud, as if Jacobs had snapped his fingers beside my ears, although he was standing at least 5 feet away. Yet all at once he was bending over me instead of standing beside the thing that wasn't a Marshall amp. The little white control box was nowhere to be seen, and my brain had gone wrong. It was stuck.
something, I said. Something, something, something happened. Happened, something happened. Something happened. Happened, something happened. Happened, something.
Stop that. You're all right. But he didn't sound sure. He sounded scared. The headphones were gone. I tried to get up and shot one hand into the air instead, like a second grader who knows the right answer and is dying to give it.
Something, something, something happened. Happened, happened, something happened.
He slapped me, and hard. I jerked backward and would have fallen over if the chair hadn't been placed almost directly against the metal side of his workshop. I lowered my hand, stopped repeating, and just looked at him. What's your name?
I'll say it's something happened, I thought. First name something, last name happened. But I didn't.
Jamie Morton. Middle name.
Edward.
My name.
Charles Jacobs.
Charles Daniel Jacobs. He produced a little bottle of heroin and gave it to me. I looked at it, then handed it back.
I'm good for now. You just gave me some.
Did I? He showed me his wristwatch. We had arrived at mid-morning. It was now 2:15 in the afternoon.
That's impossible.
He looked interested. Why's that?
Because no time passed, except I guess it did. Didn't it?
Yes. We spoke at great length.
What did we talk about?
Your father, your brothers, your mother's passing, and Claire's.
What did I say about Claire?
That she married an abusive man and kept quiet about it for 3 years because she was ashamed. She finally opened up to your brother Andy, and
his name was Paul Overton, I said. He taught English at a fancy prep school in New Hampshire.
Andy drove down there and waited in the parking lot, and when Overton showed up, Andy beat the living shit out of him. We all loved Claire. Everybody did. I suppose even Paul Overton did in his way. But she and Andy were the oldest, and they were especially close. Is that what I told you?
Almost word for word.
Andy said, if you touch her again, I'll kill you.
Tell me what else I said.
That Claire moved out, got a protection order, and sued for divorce. She moved to North Conway and got another teaching job. 6 months after the divorce became final, Overton drove up there and shot her dead in her classroom while she was correcting papers after school. Then he killed himself.
Yes, Claire dead.
Her funeral had been the last time what remained of my big, brawling, usually happy family was together. A sunny day in October. When it was over, I drove to Florida just because I'd never been there. A month later, I was playing with Patsy Cline's lipstick in Jacksonville. Gas prices were high. The climate was usually warm. And I traded my car for a Kawasaki. Not a good decision, as it turned out. In one corner of the room was a small fridge. He opened it and brought me a bottle of apple juice. I drank it down in 5 long gulps.
See if you can stand up.
I rose from the chair and staggered. Jacobs caught me by the elbow and steadied me.
Good so far.
Now walk across the room.
I did,
at first weaving like a drunk, but when I came back, I was okay. Steady Eddie.
Good, he said.
Not a sign of a limp. Let's go back to the fairgrounds. You need to rest.
Something did happen, I said.
What?
A minor restructuring of your brain waves, I believe.
You believe?
Yes.
But you don't know. He considered this for what seemed like a long time, although it might only have been seconds. It was a week before anything like a real sense of time returned to me. At last, he said, I found certain important books very difficult to obtain, and I have a long way to go in my studies as a result. Sometimes that means taking small risks, acceptable ones only. You're fine, aren't you? I thought it was too early to tell, but didn't say so. After all, the thing was done. Come on, Jamie. I've got a long night's work ahead of me, and I need rest myself. When we got to his bounder, I tried to reach for the door, and once more stuck my hand straight up in the air instead. The elbow locked. It was as if the joint had turned to iron. For one terrifying moment, I thought it would never come down, that I was just going to spend the rest of my life with one hand raised in that "teacher, teacher, call on me" gesture. Then it let go. I lowered my arm, opened the door, and got in. "That will pass," he said. "How can you know, if you don't really know exactly what you did?" "Because I've seen it before." When he was parked in his usual spot at the fairgrounds, he showed me the little bottle of heroin again. "You can have this if you want it." But I didn't. I felt like a man looking at a banana split minutes after polishing off a 9-course Thanksgiving dinner. You know that sugar-loaded treat is good, and you know that under certain circumstances you would gobble it greedily, but not after a heavy meal. After a heavy meal, a banana split is not an object of desire, but just an object. Later, maybe, I said. But later hasn't come yet. Now, as a going-on elderly man with a touch of arthritis writes of those old days, I know it never will. He cured me, but it was a dangerous cure, and he knew it. When one speaks of acceptable risks, the question is always, acceptable to whom? Charlie Jacobs was a good Samaritan. He was also a half-mad scientist, and that day in the abandoned auto body shop, I was his latest guinea pig. He could have killed me, and sometimes, many times, actually, I wish he had. I slept the remainder of the afternoon. When I woke up, I felt like an earlier version of Jamie Morton, clear-headed and full of pep. I swung my legs over the side of his bed and watched him put on his show clothes. "Tell me something," I said. "If it's about our little adventure in West Tulsa, I'd rather not discuss it. Why don't we just wait and see if you remain as you are now, or if you relapse into craving?" "Damn this tie. I can never get it right, and Briscoe is utterly useless." Briscoe was his assistant, the fellow who mugged and distracted the audience when it needed distracting. "Hold still," I said. "You're making a mess of that. Let me." I stood behind him, reached over his shoulders, and tied the tie. With the shakes gone from my hands, it was easy. Like my walk once the brain shot had worn off. They were steady eddy.
"Where did you learn that?"
"After my accident, when I could stand up and play for a couple hours without falling down, I worked with a group called the Undertakers. It hadn't been much of a group. Any band where I was the best player wasn't. We wore frock coats, stovepipe hats, and string ties. The drummer and the bass player got into a fight over a girl and the group broke up, but I came out of it with a new skill."
"Well, thank you.
What did you want to ask me?"
"About the Portraits and Lightning gig. You only take pictures of women. It seems to me that you're losing 50% of your business that way."
He grinned his boyish grin, the one he'd wore when he was leading the games in the Parsonage basement. "When I invented the portrait camera, which is actually a combined generator and projector, as I'm sure you know, I did attempt to do both men and women. This was at a little seaside amusement park in North Carolina called Joyland. Out of business now, but it was a lovely place, Jamie. I enjoyed it greatly. During my time in the Midway, which was called Joyland Avenue, there was a rogues gallery next to Mysterio's Mirror Mansion. It featured life-size cardboard figures with cutouts where the faces belonged. There was a pirate, a gangster with an automatic, a tough Jane with a Tommy gun, the Joker and Catwoman from the Batman comics. People would put their faces in, and the park's traveling photographers,
Hollywood girls, they were called, would snap the pictures. That gave you the idea.
Yes.
At the time, I was styling myself Mr. Electrico, an homage to Ray Bradbury. But I doubt if any of the rubes knew it. And although I had invented a crude version of my current projector, it had never crossed my mind to feature it in the show. Mostly I used the Tesla coil and a spark generator called Jacob's Ladder. I demonstrated a small Jacob's Ladder to you kids when I was your minister, Jamie. I used chemicals to make the rising sparks change color. Do you remember?
I did.
The Rogues Gallery made me aware of the possibilities inherent in my projector, and I created Portraits and Lightning. Just another gaffe, you'd say. But it also helped me to advance my studies, and still does. During my stint at Joyland, I used a backdrop featuring a man in expensive black tie as well as the beautiful girl in the ball gown. Some men took me up on it, but surprisingly few. I believe their shit-kicker friends laughed at them when they saw them dressed to the nines like that. Women never laugh, because women love dressing to the nines, to the tens if possible, and when they see the demonstration, they line up. How long have you been gigging? He calculated, one eye squinted shut. Then he opened them both wide in an expression of surprise. It's almost 15 years now. I shook my head, smiling. You went from preaching to huckstering. As soon as it was out of my mouth, I realized it was a mean thing to say. But the idea of my old minister turning tip still boggled my mind. He wasn't offended, though. He just gave his perfectly knotted tie a final admiring look in the mirror and tipped me a wink. No difference, he said. They're both just a matter of convincing the rubes. Now please excuse me while I go and sell some lightning. He left the heroin on the little table in the middle of the bounder. I glanced at it from time to time, even picked it up once. But I had no urge to use any. To tell you the truth, I couldn't